Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, maintaining an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business, in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Reston, Virginia, and Greater Boston. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik. And John, I think I saw you coming out of the Goodwill store recently. John and I live in the same town. And so we see each other. The other day, in fact, I pulled up alongside him on a two-lane road, and I beeped, and I said, "That's me, your partner here." And he was a little startled. Well, John, yeah, I just did afford to get a car, so I know John was shocked about that.
Yeah. Well, I go to the Goodwill stores and I go to some of them because finding CDs is almost impossible, and I love CDs. I love using CDs.
Well, I've
got
to
disappearing.
And if my brother-in-law, Steve, is listening, he absolutely loves these stores. And he lives down in North Carolina. He's got a favorite one that he goes to all the time. And he's got this little sanctuary in his home where he collects things. And he's so excited when I go down there to show me, "Look, I got a signed book by Jimmy Carter, signed by the president." And I said, "Wow, that's amazing." And then he's got duplicates of books, which drives my sister mad because he's a collector.
That would make my way.
But he's got a whole room full of stuff, and he keeps saying that he's going to catalog it and all. I don't know if he's listening. I hope he doesn't mind that I'm sharing this. But look, we all like a good bargain. My mother, may she rest in peace, she loved going to tag sales and flea markets and just the relationships that you build. And, John, recently I met a guy, he and his wife, in retirement. This is all they've done. Is
wow.
Buy and sell. And
well, that's the new thing. You can go online and, you know, take pictures of the stuff. And
but he also goes and puts out a table on Saturday mornings at various stops. No, but really, it's a society. It's a culture.
Yeah. I hate haggling with people like that. You know, hey, just take it. You know,
I'll tell you, you and I, as I said, live in the same town. Every year we have an annual tag sale day.
The townwide tag sale.
And we used to do it. We don't do it anymore. Just taking all the stuff out to the front and then returning most of it at the end of the day.
Yeah, and haggling with people. It just drove me crazy. My daughter would leave me. She'd put the stuff out there and then, "Oh, Dad, could you watch for a little while?" Like, yeah, okay.
Well, look, John, we all like a good bargain. I mean, let's be honest about it. So, you know, it's interesting. I gave probably the only joke I've ever given to a professional comedian that he actually used. I went up to see Rob Bartlett, who is a regular in the old days on the old Imus in the morning program, a brilliant guy. And we were in Torrington, Connecticut. And I said to him, "Hey, Rob," this was backstage, "did you ever think you'd be playing a town where the anchor store in the downtown right across the street was a Salvation Army thrift shop?" And he used that on stage when he went up there.
But it's a great way to recycle. It is.
No, it really is, John.
You know,
and in fact,
tools that I need instead of
saying, it is. And there's a whole economy that is built around this. So now we're going to bear in and we're going to get serious. And our topic today is about the secondhand economy. And Adam Minter is our guest. John, he wrote Junkyard Planet. This guy is an incredible chronicler of economy here in our society and around the world. And the new book, Secondhand, Travels in the New Global Garage Sale, is a remarkable book. It really is.
You find some unique people, I tell you.
Well, he's great. And this is a really important topic because this is not just a small economy we're talking about here, particularly, as you say, with the digitalization of it all. This is a big business.
Wow. I never realized it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, look at eBay, John. I mean, what that has done in and of itself.
You're right. It's huge. I didn't think about that.
One of the things that is really evident when we talk to Adam is the fact that I think there are a lot of customers for a lot of the goods because we Americans are very disposable in the way that we look at our items, and many of them are made to be obsolete sooner than later. But yet we may not find the right market for them, because that market may not be in our community, may not even be in America. But somewhere out in this vast world, somebody could use these clothes or these goods. How they get around is a fascinating topic, and whether, in fact, it is easy to move secondhand items around the world, and yet they could benefit so many people in so many different places.
Yeah, I'm sure clothing in places and... Yeah.
Well, whenever I go away, even down to the Caribbean or whatever, I often see a New York Yankees T-shirt or whatever, and a lot of these goods do get around. So let's talk to Adam Minter about this. A fascinating topic today, and don't be ashamed. I mean, we all go to Goodwill stores, and there's nothing wrong with it. And in fact, it's part of a bigger economy. Secondhand today on America Trends.
Well, if you love going to tag sales, flea market, the used bookstores, vintage clothing centers, the Goodwill store down the street, this is really the podcast for you. Adam Minter is joining us. He's written a remarkable book called Secondhand, Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. And Adam, I know we're going to talk about a lot of the nuts and the bolts and a lot of the amazing economics surrounding this business. But first, I'd like to talk about it in emotional terms, how people get attached not only to their stuff, but then to the notion of this treasure hunt, looking at other people's old stuff. I know my mother was deeply into it. May she rest in peace. My brother-in-law loves it. You can find him among the stacks at all used bookstores or Goodwill, and he is so proud of the things that he's found. So this is quite an industry. I mean, it really is.
It really is, and you know, as I write in the book, I grew up in it. You know, I was born actually in a family that owned a small metal recycling yard since the early 20th century, and so we had always had an interest. We, you know, dating back to my great grandfather, always had an interest in the stuff that other people throw away and that we could find value in. And, you know, that wasn't just recyclables, old metal coming out of homes, you know, like brass plumbing scrap, but it was the antiques. And some of my earliest memories are, as a toddler even, going to garage sales in suburban Minneapolis with my grandmother, you know, digging through the stuff, seeking out those things. And that made an impression on two levels. I mean, I remember as a very small child even wondering why people would want to let go of these wonderful things, and also being somewhat exhilarated by the fact that my grandmother was so capable of finding them, you know, and finding value where others didn't. And so, you know, my interest in the subject really dates back then, and I continue to be, you know, amazed really at how important stuff has become to us, especially in America, and how we build our identities in many cases around our things. You know, nobody knows this really better than the big tech companies like Google and Facebook, which very carefully track the stuff we buy and like, and then try to sell more back to us based upon, you know, these profiles they build of us. So it's a very deep subject that touches all aspects of our culture.
Well, I know that my mother loved the friendships that built around these tag sales, about the people and learning about them and their history and where these items came from and what they meant to them. But is this a mom and pop business, or is this much more and profoundly engaging on a macro level across the world?
Well, the answer to the question is yes. It's both. It is still a mom and pop business. I mean, you know, the origins of the business, you know, the supply chain ultimately leads back to our closets and garages and basements. And, you know, if anybody who sells at a garage sale or has a table at a flea market is part of a global industry, they just might not see it. They may think they're just selling to a neighbor or somebody at the flea market who drove into town. But the stuff that doesn't sell tends to enter, and even the stuff that does sell tends to enter much bigger economies. You know, I spent a lot of time with Goodwill, especially in Arizona, looking at what happens to the stuff that doesn't sell in their stores. And only about one third of the stuff sells off the shelves in your average Goodwill retail operation. Where does that
stuff
go?
I was always wondering about that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an amazing number when you think about it. And Goodwill doesn't just simply throw that stuff away, because throwing stuff away is a cost. You have to pay for the landfilling and or wherever else you send it. And so they actively seek out global markets and global for these things that we drop off, that we have pulled out of our closet saying, I don't want that in my home anymore. And that stuff, apparel, for example, can go, any number of places, South Asia, Southeast Asia, East Africa, West Africa. And, as much as, the global markets and equities, fluctuate day by day, with supply and demand, so do the global markets for apparel, used apparel, global markets for used cars, which is a very big secondhand electronics like smartphones. So, it is both macro and micro, and it's constantly changing, and it's in, a real state of flux right now.
And why is that? I mean, you do point out that America, we have so much stuff, and yet we have difficulty at times getting it to people who actually would value it across the globe. It's almost like food. We make plenty of it across the world, but it's the distribution and getting it to the right people that causes some of the problems we have in terms of supply for so many across the globe.
Sure. Well, it's a really interesting question. So, backing up from sort of reusable stuff, I'll tell you from just my growing up in recycling, the recycling industry in a small scrapyard, oftentimes your profit margin, if you're selling, say, a bunch of old plumber scrap to somebody who will smelt that into new brass, the profit margin is often the cost of logistics, trucking that from, say, Minneapolis to Chicago. You make money on if you can find a good cheap option of moving it. And one of the great problems in moving all of this used stuff around the world is the cost of the logistics. Filling a container with a bunch of used furniture that would be highly sought, say, in a place like Ghana or Togo or Benin or Nigeria, there's the demand there. But, shipping that container, say, from Boston to Accra, Ghana, is going to cost $5,000. And there just isn't enough money to pull out of it. So as a result, you can't get the stuff to people. I mean, it's really all a matter of proximity and those logistics. In the book, I spent quite a bit of time showing how the trade over the U.S.-Mexico border in secondhand stuff works. And in Arizona, it's upwards of 90% of the stuff coming out of the Goodwills is actually moving to wholesalers of used stuff in Mexico. But that works because it's relatively cheap to drive a pickup, say, from Tucson to Nogales. You can't say the same if you're shipping that same stuff to South Asia, somewhere like India. So a lot of it comes down to the logistics of moving it.
Absolutely. What about with eBay and all of the online commerce in secondhand stuff, moving it away from the thrift shops, the flea markets? Mm-hmm. How brisk a business is that, and how much has that grown this entire sector?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. In some respects, it hasn't changed that much. Certainly when eBay came onto the scene in the 1990s, it really blew up and people were really into it. But what eBay transformed wasn't it didn't transform the buying and selling of the excess clothing in our closet so much. What it really transformed was the collectibles market. So if you had, a certain Hummel figurine, which are these porcelain German figurines, and you wanted to find a matching one, before eBay, it was really hard. It was a real treasure hunt. But with the advent of eBay, you could go online and see that there's 16 people, selling that very figurine that day. And so it really revolutionized how we sell sort of these higher end used objects. But the stuff of daily life, whether it be Tupperware or an old shirt that one might buy at a mass retailer, not a luxury retailer, but say somewhere like a Target or Costco or Walmart, that stuff doesn't sell on eBay because, again, it comes down to the logistics and the time involved in selling it. How much money are you going to get for that shirt you paid $9.99 for 3 years ago? And then, what's it going to cost you to ship it to somebody and the trouble of posting it online? So it's really been at the upper end of the market. And even though we've seen a proliferation of these apps, I spent some time with the company Poshmark, which has an app for people to buy and sell clothing from each other. Again, if you look at what is being bought and sold on that app, it's, you know, the most popular stuff is expensive brands like Lululemon and Patagonia. It's not the mid-market brands. And so it's made it much easier to sell, you know, sort of really good stuff, as I call it in the book. But that mass market, you know, the cake underneath that sort of luxury frosting isn't moving through those ads.
What role does planned obsolescence and the availability of cheap goods today play in this entire secondhand market?
Well, you know, on the topic of cheap goods, I mean, I think all of your listeners, you know, especially in the United States, they've all at some point said, in some form or another, they don't make it like they used to, you know, and they might be saying that about their clothing, you know, they may buy a specific brand of clothing and, you know, they might look back 20 years ago, they say, you know, that was better made. It lasted more washes, you know, televisions, you know, the tube televisions, you know, those things can last for decades. And most of these flat panels we're finding, these days, you know, they're, you know, a lot of them, you know, especially like the $150 ones I was seeing at Best Buy, you know, on Black Friday, you know, those you're lucky to get through 3-4 years with them without at least having a problem. And that's a real and measurable phenomenon, and it has been measured. And what's bad about that for the secondhand market is the secondhand market depends on having good, durable stuff. You know, a nonprofit like Goodwill, they'll take your you know, lousy, you know, 1-to-5 wash shirt. They'll take it, but it's very hard for them to sell it and to make any kind of money from it. And if you spend time around the Goodwill donation rooms and talk to the people who sort clothes and other used goods there, these are very sophisticated people. This is not, you know, an unskilled job. They will tell you the quality is declining, and they've seen it decline precipitously over the past few years. And for someone like Goodwill, that means that the used stuff, the donations, become a cost. They have to pay. If not for disposal, they're going to have to pay more to, you know, to ship them to places like rag makers who transform old clothes into rags rather than reusing them as clothes. They have to pay them. And so it becomes harder for them to operate. And thrift stores around the United States and in Europe and Japan are all facing this problem that they have to collect more stuff to get the good stuff because there's so much more of the low quality stuff.
Interesting. Adam Minter, yeah. Secondhand yeah. Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. Are most of us hoarders? And I ask that in the context of what you address early on in the book, and that is that we have an aging population. We do collect a lot of stuff. It has become a part of our culture in a major way. And so it makes it so difficult for this generation that's coming up, the millennials, as they are forced to deal with all the stuff that their parents have collected. But do we represent a hoarding culture?
Well, I think we represent a hoarding species, to be honest with you. You know, early in the process of reporting this book, I spent quite a bit of time with people who professionally clean out homes. So when a senior decides to downsize into senior housing, or if somebody passes away and the, you know, a home is left behind with a lot of stuff in it, you can actually, in the United States and a few other countries, hire people to help you go through it and sort of counsel.
Well, I learned from your book about the Association of Clean Out Professionals.
Yeah, move managers. Yeah, that's what they're called. It's an extraordinary profession, and it's expanding very quickly. There are some 600 companies that belong in the United States just to that association. Mm. And I spent time with really one of the best, a woman by the name of Jill Freeman, who works for a company called Gentle Transitions in the Twin Cities. It was one of the earliest companies. And Jill told me something very interesting, because I brought up with her, you know, the idea of hoarders, and I said, do you ever do hoarding homes? You know, other, you know, as opposed to homes by people who are not hoarders. And she gave me this look, and she said, hoarding is a spectrum disorder, and we're all on it. It's just a question of where. And in the course of reporting this book, I found that to be the case. We think of hoarding as an American phenomenon, but I spent quite a bit of time reporting this book in Japan, going to clean outs and seeing homes being downsized or cleaned out there. And I can tell you they have the same problems we have. They just have smaller homes. And so in that sense, it actually can oftentimes make it far worse. But you're absolutely right. I mean, as societies age, the United States has, you know, the boomers aging, and they've had a very affluent life, and they have very large homes, and they're filled with stuff. You know, is it a hoarder home or not? Where do you land on the spectrum disorder? And the same thing is happening in Japan.
Stay with us for more of this great conversation in just a moment. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers over 40 years of experience in a broad base of services from accounting and tax to cybersecurity, technology, and transaction advisory. Bloom's experts will maintain an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
How widely, though, do consumption patterns vary around the globe? I mean, you say that in Japan, I found that interesting, of course, they can't really fill up to the same degree because their homes are smaller. But what do you notice around the globe?
Well, one thing you learn if you report on the waste and recycling trade, and I've been reporting on it now for almost two decades.
Adam is the author of Junkyard Planet, which was a classic, and about that whole area. So we're not really delving into that, but help us understand the parallel that we can draw between the two.
Sure. Well, one thing you learn really quickly in reporting that stuff is that the wealthier society is, the more it consumes and the more it throws away. And, you know, if you weren't measuring GDP in countries, you could just go and measure how much garbage they're generating. As they become affluent, they throw away more. And it's axiomatic. It's never been the case that a country became more affluent and started throwing away less. And so these problems really track affluence. And, you know, we've had an enormous amount of economic growth globally over the last really 40 years. And countries that we previously associated as being very poor and developing or emerging are now consuming in ways that should feel very familiar to Americans. And they are doing the same thing. And so it's not an American thing. I think it's a very human thing. You know, I spent 12 years living in China from 2002 to 2014, which was a period of extraordinary growth. And I thought, you know, just in my apartment building, people, you know, when I first moved into that building, I lived there for 10 years, the hallways were, you know, were bare. But by the time I moved out in 2014, people had so much stuff, they were putting furniture in the hallways because they didn't have anywhere else to store it. So it was a very familiar story to me.
How important is history in all of this? By that, I mean, my brother-in-law loves to go to various collection centers, and he really digs into the history of a book, how it traveled, the meaning of it, maybe if it's got an autograph attached to it. I think he got one from Jimmy Carter. He had signed it, and he was really fascinated by that. I mean, how much of this is a treasure hunt? And how many of the folks that we're talking about are really, in a sense, closet history buffs?
Well, you know, the collectibles market and sort of that high-end market is such a small part of the overall secondhand trade, but it for a lot of reasons it gets outside interest. One, because it tends to be a lot more interesting to find that, you know, that history book, you know, that's very valuable both historically and financially than it is to, you know, look into a shipping container full of secondhand clothes shipped from Toronto. You know, there's not going to be much of particular interest there. And so, you know, it's quite natural in that way. But one thing I've sort of learned over the years, and I really picked it up in Japan, is how much people do value the opportunity of sort of curating stuff. And this really came to my attention at one particular vintage store, antique store in Tokyo, where the owner was starting to attach labels to secondhand stuff that had come from people's homes, explaining where it came from, who owned it, when they got it, what it meant to them. And, you know, he saw it as a nice thing to do, but the really interesting part of it is he found that if he was able to share those stories with his customers, the stuff moved more. People were more inclined to buy it because they sort of had this emotional investment in it. We all have emotional investments in our own stuff, but it was really interesting to me that people wanted to have that emotional investment in a sense in somebody else's stuff and have this feeling, these emotions associated with sort of taking care of it for somebody else who they may not have ever known, or for that matter might not have even liked. It's really a fascinating phenomenon.
It is. And as we get older, it's interesting, there are many things that I never wanted to part with. And as we start thinking about not wanting to burden our kids with all of our stuff, because truthfully, Adam, and you know this, they don't want it. They're not living in the same suburban tracts that we have lived. And they're living in urban areas, and they have less room. And they really aren't that sentimental about the stuff that we have, because they have new toys and new gadgets and new things. And I think America has always been fascinated with that new shiny object.
Yeah, exactly. And this is one of the things that's really causing problems in the vintage furniture market, but also in things that, you know, for instance, my grandparents' generation, you know, considered collectible and valuable. I spent time at an antique mall in Stillwater, Minnesota, and it, you know, there were a lot of interesting experiences there related to this phenomenon. But the one that made the biggest impression upon me was when the manager of the shop, Dick Richter is his name, said to me, he pointed to the display window at the front of the antique mall, and he said, 18 months ago that had, you know, antique glass in it, you know, which was a really, really highly sought collectible, especially by my grandmother's generation. It's something that he loved. He was an older gentleman. And he said, but nobody wants that stuff anymore. They've passed on. And so instead of having this antique glass, this carnival glass that an older generation really loved, now the stuff in the window is Pyrex. And Pyrex, if your listeners know, was a kitchenware. My mother used it. I mean, she put salads in it, and it was nothing.
Absolutely.
But he said, that's what the new generation of collectors want. And some Pyrex bowls, and I looked this up, and he wasn't joking, can go for thousands of dollars, which would just make my mother's head spin. You know, we put salads in, you know, buy it for $2,000, $3,000. And you know, I asked him, you know, what happened? And he said, well, the collectibles market has always been defined by the same thing, and that is a certain degree of nostalgia. I remember mom having this, you know. I remember my parents using this, my grandparents using this. And as the as an older generation passes on and those memories go, the stuff that they coveted and collected declines in value, and other stuff, you know, rises in value. And that's partly what we're seeing right now. And then it also the decline in value of some of these collectibles and you know, vintage things also just goes back to what you were saying is changing taste. You know, home ownership is down for younger people, and they tend to be living in shorter term places, renting. And so the heavy oak furniture that was beloved for a century in the United States, those 300-pound desks and tables, you know, you don't want to move that every 2-3 years. You know,
no,
you know,
getting
you
that know, up a windy don't... staircase in New York City.
Exactly.
It's just
exactly.
Too much. Now, you say that used car data is really plentiful. We can find it almost anywhere. But beyond the numbers for cars, the numbers about this industry and so many other product lines is really difficult to get, even in the U.S., but awful internationally.
Yeah, this is a particular pain point for me as a business journalist. When I started this book, I just assumed, like every industry I cover, I could start by Googling and just see, you know, getting the industry data, how many garage sales are there per year, you know, how much stuff moves into thrift stores, how much clothing is exported, you know, say from, you know, the UK to Ghana. And those numbers either don't exist or they are notoriously spotty. And there's a really, you know, pretty good reason for this, and that is that, you know, our economic statistics takers and makers globally tend to be focused on the production of new things. I mean, we live in consumer economies. Everybody wants a consumer economy as they develop, and so they focus on how many new widgets are being produced in the factories, how many new widgets are being sold in the retail stores, how many are being exported, and you can get very, very fine data on, you know, very, very, you know, obscure products. But, you know, when they're focusing on that, and when we think globally in terms of growth and just economies in terms of new stuff, the used stuff gets short shrift, and that's a big mistake in my mind. I spent a lot of time in West Africa for this book. And if you've ever spent time in West Africa or you go, one of the first things you'll notice in the big cities, or at least I did, is that, you know, depending on where you are, it can be up to 90% to 95% of the retail trade is secondhand. But nobody's capturing this. And in emerging markets, they really don't want to capture it because they want investors. And if they tell, you know, investors, you know, investing in emerging markets, we have these really thriving secondhand economies, you know, in northern Ghana. That's not going to excite them. They want to know that people are reaching levels of affluence where they can and will and want to buy new stuff. And so that stuff, it's just there's not much of an incentive to report it.
So when we read about GDP and the output of an economy, should we assume that these numbers are submerged and are not part of that? And is a lot of that because it's also a cash economy in many ways in terms of the secondhand market?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's the other component of this. I mean, GDP does not account for this. And if you go into emerging market economies, the other factor, and it's equally destructive, at least in terms of data taking, is the fact that many of these emerging market economies have prohibited the import and export of secondhand goods, or at least certain kinds of them. So, I mean, some of the biggest in the world, India, Nigeria, and Mexico are some of the most notable ones where new manufacturers have pressured governments into either raising taxes so it's effectively a ban or simply banning them. But the amazing thing is even with these bans, you don't have to go far into Mexico. You can literally walk across the border. You're going to see thriving markets in secondhand stuff imported from the United States. Likewise, if you go to Nigeria, you don't even have to go to Nigeria. You go to Benin, which borders it on the east, and it's become basically a big hub for smuggling secondhand goods into Nigeria. And by smuggling, I don't mean people are, you know, digging tunnels underneath the border. The border crossings between Benin and Nigeria are notoriously corrupt. If you go through them, there's five or six tolls. And I can tell you that, you know, they're government tolls, and they take a look at what you have, and then they let it through. And so people who want to buy cars cheap in Nigeria, they go to Benin, they buy the cars there, they pay the five toll takers, if you will, and they have a secondhand used car imported from Europe in Nigeria. But clearly government statistics aren't going to capture this, and a lot of it is cash business. And so, again, it's a whole side of the economy that just isn't, the global economy, that just isn't accounted for.
Now, let's talk about some of the benefits. Less energy, fewer raw materials used because we're reusing products just like any recycling might do when you don't really have to repurpose the product. I mean, it's there. I mean, you can clean it up and you can dress it up, you can repair it, but it's already been made. So that's a benefit in this time when we're worried about the environment, clearly.
Yeah, there's something called life cycle assessments, LCAs, which are used by manufacturers increasingly to measure the environmental impact of products. And what they'll do is they'll hire people who specialize in these, and they'll go through, you know, they'll do essentially an audit of the manufacturing process, the use process, the consumer using the good, and even the waste disposal end of it. And then they'll calculate how much water has been consumed, how many carbon emissions, how much carbon has been emitted in the course of the use of this product over its lifetime. And the one thing that comes out in all of these, but especially with digital gadgets, especially, is that the most carbon-intensive period of any product's life cycle is going to be the manufacturing side, which makes sense. There's a lot of energy that goes into manufacturing raw materials and then assembling a product. And so what comes out of that is the idea that if you really want to reduce the carbon footprint, just talking about carbon for right now, of your consumption, the best way to do that is to extend the life of products, make them last as long as possible so that there isn't the need to manufacture a new one so quickly. And so that's really the ultimate environmental benefit of this. If you're using stuff longer, there's less manufacturing of new, and the carbon emissions go down. So, you know, from an environmental standpoint, it's great. You know, I also argue, though, that there is a social and even psychological benefit. Anybody who's had to clean out a parent's or grandparent's home and you know, had to throw away stuff and go through this process of figuring out who wants this stuff, and some of it just isn't usable because it's worn down, it's not very good. The idea that you can actually give it to somebody or sell it to somebody and it'll get used, it's almost a primal need, and it's a much better feeling than putting it in a trash bag. And so, you know, if we're all buying better, more durable stuff, stuff that can be sold into a secondhand market, I mean, it has that benefit. It takes away some of the sting, and it can be quite the sting if you've ever gone through it, of having to literally toss somebody's stuff after they've passed or done.
Oh, it's absolutely their life, and we know that many of our lives end up in a box in our kids' basement and not looked at very often, even though it meant so much to us. Let me ask you in closing, the impact of growing affluence, you address this in the book, that because many societies are doing a bit better economically, they do want new stuff. So we have growing piles of unwanted stuff.
Yes, we do. And that's one of the big challenges for the secondhand market and sustainably minded consumers and manufacturers around the world over coming years, is the fact that, you know, countries like China, which was once a big importer of used goods, is now becoming a major exporter. In West Africa, where I spent time for this book, I was astounded to see Chinese clothes, you know, being sold at street stalls, you know, alongside American used clothes and, European used clothes. And what this big flood of Chinese clothes that's just starting right now but is going to grow you know, what it's going to do is it's going to really challenge the secondhand market, because it's just basic economics. There's going to be a lot of supply, and the demand as other countries become affluent is probably going to decline. And so, you know, how that plays out over coming years, I'm not sure. But I, you know, I think it's a worrisome trend, and I think it's a real reminder to both manufacturers and consumers that if they want to see the secondhand economy, it's really incumbent upon them to be buying stuff that's good, that's durable, that can be reused, that consumers, not just in developing economies, but developed economies will want to reuse. So those are some of the challenges that we're really facing ahead of us.
Yeah, you tell us that the crisis is not really quantity, it's quality. You also tell us, and I guess I hadn't put this into perspective until reading your book, that opposition to globalization, you know, all this nationalism that we talk about today,
right,
is putting limits on the goods getting from rich countries to poor countries. You would hope that no matter how this nationalism exhibits itself, that it wouldn't affect the ability for us to move goods across markets, particularly when there's a need in another place that's greater than our need for it.
Yeah, I would say a demand. I mean, Mexico is a wonderful example of, you know, like as I said earlier, the Goodwill of Southern Arizona, you know, believes that roughly 90% of its customers are coming up from Mexico. If they are somehow prevented from engaging in that trade, you know, if the border somehow becomes less porous, that's going to put a lot of stress on Southern Arizona to find, you know, they're going to need to figure out somewhere else for that stuff to go. And in many cases, if it can't go to Mexico, it's going to end up in a landfill. It's going to become a much higher cost, not just for Goodwill and the charities down there, but also the citizens of that region. And similar, you know, sorts of problems emerge not just with Mexico, but shipping things to places like Africa. You know, the fact of the matter is secondhand often is a trade that moves between more affluent to less affluent people. And, you know, insofar as we have trade barriers, whether it be in countries in Africa or more likely, and what often is happening is a developed country saying, no, we shouldn't be dumping this stuff on emerging markets. That means that they're not going to have access to secondhand goods. They're going to have to opt for new goods, and it's going to be then forcing the developed countries to figure out where to actually go with the stuff, and it's going to end up being places that don't do reuse. It's going to be incinerators. It's going to be trash landfills.
Adam Minter, of course, he was the author of Junkyard Planet. Go back and get that. It's worth reading or rereading. Secondhand Travels and the New Global Garage Sale. What a fascinating conversation. What great reporting. Thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you for having me.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.